The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed in the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
The following program presents and discusses general mental health topics. This program should not be interpreted as medical advice. Please consult your doctor if you have any questions about topics discussed on this program and if they apply to your situation. Welcome to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. We will talk about and feature a variety of behavioral health issues. We also invite you, the listener, to contribute to the discussion through calls as well. Now, here is your host, Dr. Sarita Rao.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. Today's topic is about women, drugs, and pregnancy. And we're basically going to be talking about women and addictions. And our guest today is Dr. Richard Soper. So women suffer from drug and alcohol addiction in large numbers in society, yet they often remain actively using and fearful of seeking treatment. According to statistics from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, SAMHSA, a large federal government agency, up to 6.9 million women may need treatment, but they're not reaching out to get it. And another 118,000 women are waiting to enter treatment, and about 319,000 women feel they need treatment, but they're not making any effort to get it. So why these numbers? Even though women suffer from drug and alcohol addiction in numbers comparable to that of men, even today, there is more social stigma and shame associated with any type of addictive illness among women than with their male counterparts. And society also has preconceived ideas about what a mother should be, and having an active addiction does not really fit in with their idea of a good mother. A large percentage of women who go on to develop addictive illnesses have had childhood trauma, including childhood sexual abuse. And then they're often victimized again as adults as they go on to develop addictions. They could be victims of domestic violence, rape, or sometimes they exchange sex for drugs, but they feel very demeaned and humiliated in the process. And then this leads to a vicious cycle of more self-medication with drugs or alcohol and then re-traumatization. Then when they enter treatment, women will often share that if they share some of these traumatic sexual experiences with their group therapy, sometimes some of the men in the group therapy sessions or in 12-step meetings see them differently and treat them differently, and this then further makes them shamed, angry, humiliated. A lot of times this can be helped by having gender-specific groups so that they go into groups only with women and or go to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous meetings that are women-only meetings, and then they could share more freely. A lot of times their husbands and significant others and boyfriends are very frustrated and angry about the addiction, and they may leave and take custody of the children legally, not allowing the mother to see the kids because they feel it's the best thing for the children. But then this really creates a huge grief issue for the mother and also does impact the children to be separated. Psychologically, it impacts them. Pregnant women who are actively using drugs or alcohol have further significant challenges. This is a time where most women try their best to stop or cut back on their use. Access to treatment is often an issue, especially to a mothers and children's program where the person can stay with their newborn baby after the delivery to stay clean, to strengthen their recovery during this crucial period of their lives. And a lot of pregnant drug-using women may not get prenatal care because they're afraid to go for prenatal care because they feel if they disclose about their active use, it may have an effect, a negative effect on the custody of older kids and also the new baby, and the Department of Children and Families would get involved and they're afraid of them. But engaging women, especially mothers or any women, in treatment and recovery can have really far-reaching positive effects on their lives, but also their children's lives, and then extending it forward to families and society in general. And treating a pregnant drug-using mother has significant benefits to both the mother and the baby. Even if the mother spends a few months of the pregnancy, the last few months, in a treatment program, getting prenatal care regularly, having some stability, and the baby can be freed from the effects of drugs, it has a positive effect on the outcome and on the health of the mother and the baby. In a large percentage of these families, the children remain very emotionally attached to their mother, and separation from them into foster homes or even a family member is not an ideal solution because it doesn't fill the hole left behind by the missing mother. So, keeping their children with them if they are not pregnant but they have young children can be a huge issue if they don't have anyone that they consider dependable to look after their kids while they go to treatment. They often choose not to go because then they're afraid to leave them with people they don't consider reliable, or they're afraid if they go, Department of Children and Families will place their kids in a foster home and they may not get them back. And this is especially true if they're the primary caregiver and there's no reliable other parent or family member who can look after the kids. So the first step to treating women with substance use disorders who are a diverse group is to have a more open approach to discussing this illness that afflicts men and women alike, and to realize that a mother who is addicted to drugs and alcohol loves her children but has a disease and may need help to be able to stop. And then women's only groups or tracks within a larger program are very helpful because the women can feel more free to share their experiences without fear of being judged. And in terms of 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, they're crucial to recovering from drug or alcohol addiction. And there are many meetings in most areas that are women-only, or at least a few meetings, even in small rural areas. And the women can, you know, safely attend those meetings. They can get some identification with the other members about gender-specific life experiences. A lot of these women have not had a positive experience in relationships with other women, and they avoid it. And this gives them a chance to build and engage in healthy female relationships, which in turn can go a long way to increase their self-confidence, self-esteem, sense of self-reliance. And the rule in 12-step programs is that the sponsor should be of the same gender as the person trying to recover. And this is very helpful with identification and helping people to develop relationships with other women. So our guest today is Dr. Richard Soper. He is a physician as well as an attorney, and he is specialized in addiction medicine, forensic psychiatry, general psychiatry, and also pathology. So it's a really unique set of training and experience that you don't normally encounter. So welcome to our show, Dr. Soper.
Thank you, Sarita. Good morning to everyone. And very comprehensive statement to begin with. I have to say congratulations to summarize this very complex and difficult chronic mental health issue that we are facing in our society and at large. I totally concur with everything that you said. Is, I think, one of the most recent shocking statements that I saw in the media just a week or so ago is the World Health Organization statement that one in three women in our world are suffering from domestic violence. And I think, as you alluded to, there's just so many causes and complexities to the issue of how any of us in our society try to cope with the challenges that we have in our lives. And I think women, whether they're pregnant or not pregnant, same as men, many times go to self-medicating, whether it's with alcohol or tobacco or opiates or other substances. And the same statement can be made, as you alluded to, whether it's pregnant or non-pregnant women, using the two most common drugs that are used by non-pregnant and pregnant women are alcohol and tobacco. And then after that, we've seen in our society in the last 15 or so years a very significant increase, even to the point where our Center for Disease Control and federal government are using the word of epidemic, of an epidemic of opioid prescription drug abuse and addiction. And in my area of the country, I'm in the Southeast, we're now also seeing a very significant transition from prescription opiates to heroin. So this problem is not going to go away. We're seeing, and we can talk about, some of the seeds for the challenges that women face begin back in early childhood within their family unit and with their family of origin.
Right. And I think that a lot of people, you know, aren't aware of this epidemic of opiates, prescription opiates, heroin. And, you know, in the Northeast, it's been going on for a long time now, and it's not showing any signs of abating or going down. So in your own, clinical experience of working with women with substance abuse problems, like, what would you say is the biggest challenges for them in terms of like even entering treatment or staying in treatment? Because all the research has shown that the longer people stay in treatment, that's a big predictor of how well they do.
Absolutely. And that is the same outcomes metrics that we see, the same measurements that we see for women and men. The longer that you're in treatment, the longer that you are in some form of recovery network, that you have that safety net, the better the outcome. And some of the particular challenges, as you alluded to in your opening statement, Sarita, for women, especially childbearing age that have children, they have to many of them are single parents, and they have to not just consider their own needs, but the needs of their children, the needs of their family unit. Women, there really are significant gender differences in this chronic primary medical disorder, in that women very many times start later in life, but that age is continuing to move down with this disorder. The consequences are much more significant, and it's much harder for them. They're still stigmatized. They're still much more marginalized. For whatever reason, our society still considers it a weakness for a woman to come forward and seek help, versus many times, unfortunately, my gender, they see it as a point where someone's trying to reach help and trying to gain help, and they're allowed easier to enter. In my own area of practice, many times if it's a nurse or if it's a young female professional or even a female that's a housewife, when they come forward, the consequences, whether it's from the courts of law or whether it's family or whether it's employers, are much more significant than a man. Some of the challenges, as I alluded to, is they suffer from that loss of income. They suffer from family, as you alluded to, many times when they talk with their husband or their significant other or their family, they turn away from them or they banish them or they tell them they need to leave the family unit. So the challenge is, and I'm so glad that you're having this discussion, and in fact, it's becoming more apparent and it's becoming more of an issue in our society where we're finally addressing. Even if you look at, as you alluded to, in 12-step meetings, same gender for your sponsor, same gender meetings, the number of halfway houses, the number of inpatient treatment centers that are available for women are much less than those that are available for men.
Right. And then, you know, there's, I think a lot of times it's very complex because, you know, what I see as an addiction psychiatrist is everything you described. And then sometimes because of the women's own childhood experiences and, you know, they've been traumatized. So, they don't trust anyone for that matter, but they tend to form, you know, relationships with men, even if they're unhealthy, because they have this illusion that they can control them in some way when actually they're not controlling them. But then they tend to a lot of times not trust other women and have very few truly trusting female relationships in their lives. So, but then in a strange kind of way, this ends up isolating them. And then, we talked about domestic violence. A lot of women who are in domestic violence situations where they're physically abused by their husbands or boyfriends or significant others, part of the reason they started using drugs and alcohol is so that they could tolerate that kind of lifestyle and still stay there. But then it becomes a barrier where they can't leave because now they're impaired, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And I think it's that old proverbial, any of us in life that are victimized, we try to play that out again throughout much of the rest of our lives. And we can go back to even some of the Viktor Frankl and other studies that have been done where the individual that is the victim attempts to try to play that out and have a different outcome. So if, in fact, the perpetrator in the past, if the person that was victimizing the young woman was male, they're drawn more to. And many times in my own patient population, I'm sure with yours, that the young ladies will say they're not comfortable around other women, or they perceive other women as threats, or they think the other woman is potentially trying to harm them in different ways, whether it's to steal their mate or to try to take advantage of them.
Right, right. It's that's a big challenge as we try to push them towards forming more female friendships and then trying to separate out what's a healthy female friendship where the two people are supportive of each other, not competitive, versus an unhealthy female relationship where there's a lot of, competition and sort of a mixed kind of relationship, and relationships between women are different, and they can sometimes have like various nuances. And most women learn to negotiate them from an early age. But then, if you've had traumatic experiences as a child, and then you never trusted girls or women, and then you just don't form those relationships, but then you're left with no support network when you're trying to get sober.
Well, it's almost a flip. I many times talk with patients about, don't want to use too many medical terms, know the majority of our listeners are not medical, but the interpersonal relationships and behaviors of interpersonal relationships, unfortunately, harmed individuals have a decreased ability to recognize where there is risk in interpersonal relationships and where there are emotional harm factors. And they become somewhat, many times I say it's almost like wearing a pair of dark glasses, in that you don't see the risks of what your impulsive behavior when you're drawn or attracted to someone, what those consequences might be further down the road.
That is so true. So, and that is something we must explore along with telescoping, I think, a term that most people aren't familiar with when we come out on the other side of our break. So you're listening to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. Today's topic is women, drugs, and pregnancy. If you would like to call in, we welcome callers to share your own thoughts, ideas, questions, experiences. The number is 1-866-472-5792. So it's 1-866-472-5792. We're here with Dr. Rich Soper, and we're talking about women, drugs, and pregnancy. You could find my show's Facebook page, Dr. Sarita Rao Radio Show, and find out more about upcoming guests and topics. And if you like the Facebook page, then it will automatically show up on your page with information. So thank you everyone for listening, and we'll be back on the other side of the short break.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Cancer is not something to be taken lightly. But instead of being talked at by doctors, medical providers, and others, wouldn't it be nice to hear from a host who has worked at the Cancer Coalface for 38 years as a caregiver, supporter for 14,000 patients, and who has had the experience of having a life-threatening condition herself? You will hear the stories of survivors and other people who work in breakthrough cancer medicine. Navigating the Cancer Maze with host Grace Galler will help you with the facts, planning, and grief experienced with different forms and stages of cancer. Listen every Friday at 12 noon U.S. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Helping you make informed decisions for your life. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Now, back to today's program.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. And joining us today is Dr. Richard Soper, who is a psychiatrist, trained in forensic psychiatry. He's also an attorney. He is a specialist in addiction medicine, general psychiatry, and also has a pathology training. So as we were talking about just before we went on break, women with substance abuse problems, because of traumatic childhood experiences, they often, as part of the way, a sort of brain's way of coping with traumatic experiences, sometimes people have to become a little detached, dissociated, almost like they're there but not there. Otherwise, they would never survive the trauma with any kind of sanity intact. And this, unfortunately, sometimes stays with them through life as a sort of inbuilt maladaptive coping mechanism in their brain, and they can't often see dangers either in the physical environment around them, or if they meet someone who's unsafe, they don't pick up the cues, and then they get further traumatized. So, Rich, would you have more to say about that? I really liked your dark glasses analogy. What do you tell patients when you talk to them about this?
Well, I think you summarized it very well, Sarita, and I think, again, it's a challenge for us as medical professionals to place into understandable terminology what we're dealing with, and much of that is due to, for so long, it was felt that this is character defect, not chronic disorder, and there is changes that happen in the brain reward system and in the memory and in our motivation when we go through self-medicating behaviors. So I try to explain the, and I don't know of a way to simplify this, but the neuroanatomy, meaning what happens in the nervous system and the circuitry of the nervous system when we are using substances. And just real briefly, I'd say we do know in science that the maturity of the nervous system occurs in the late teens and early 20s, and it actually matures a little bit earlier for females than males, but it is not totally mature until you're in your early 20s. So part of what happens when any of us as humans use substances to trigger the release of some of the chemicals in the nervous system, particularly in the brain reward system, when the circuitry is, when the, if you will, the insulation of the nervous system, which is much like an electrical system, when that insulation is not totally mature and we stimulate the release of those chemicals, they're stimulated to release almost in a flood. And then it sets that as a standard of what we expect or desire or want or crave or feel we need to have. So as we further move into life, we see that individuals that were traumatized or hurt or damaged early in life, and they have sought some method of, as you said, Sarita, to cope or survive with that, and they go to self-medicating behaviors, it sets the bar at a position for much of the rest of their life of what that flood of chemicals, that feeling that they want to have. So many times when I'm trying to explain to my patients that there is the ability, and thank goodness there are options medically now that haven't been around previously for us to be able to assist and help people. But where and how someone obtains drugs, how they use the drugs, who they get them from, many times, as you alluded to earlier, is a very complex picture of harm behavior.
Right, right. Well, let's talk a little bit about treatment because, you know, there's so many treatment options available. And I'm always surprised because, you know, we meet these two categories of human beings who come into substance abuse treatment programs. You know, people who've been there before, they might have done well and relapsed and come back, and they're more aware of the options. And then other people who've been, you know, actively using for a while and they, you know, weren't aware of all of the treatment options that are available. Like if you're working full time, you know, you can go to an evening chemical program. And you know, what would you say, I mean, it's a big topic, treatment options, but what would you say are treatment options that are available pretty much everywhere for, you know, women with substance abuse problems? Like, if you are a woman who has a drug or alcohol dependence, you know, a good place to start would be your primary care doctor, don't you think?
Absolutely. And if there's someone in the healthcare profession that you've had a relationship professionally with in the past that has helped you in the past, that's absolutely the first place to start. Whether that's a nurse, whether that's a physician, whether that's a physician assistant, or it's a licensed practicing nurse, but someone who you can at least say, I need some help. And the first thing that I try to tell any patient is, those of us that are medical professionals, we're here to help, not hurt. And we're here to try to assist with some of the options that are available to help repair and heal from some of the harm that has happened, and facilitate with a safety net, if you will, of individuals to know that there are other options than to just suffer from the continuing complex damage that can occur from self-medicating behaviors. And the damage stretches over emotional damage, physical damage, mental damage, family damage, spiritual damage, financial damage, legal damage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, what if they don't, you know, a lot of people, when they are actively using, they haven't seen a doctor in years, they don't really know anyone, you know, should they, you know, Google treatment, or should they just look up Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous and just go to a meeting in their area? That, to me, seems to be the simplest way to at least start out, you know.
I think those are both, all of those are good options. I think that if you have resources in your community that provide, whether it's through religious-based organization or whether it's through community services or whether it's through 12-step meetings, and many times I tell the individuals that I see in my community, patients or not, that many times the name of the 12-step meeting is not as important as the meeting itself. That if even I've had patients say, well, I really don't suffer from alcohol abuse, why should I go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? Well, if that's the only meeting in your small rural community, the people that attend are seeking help and trying to be able to assist others as part of their own program with becoming abstinent from self-destructive behavior. So any way that you're able to facilitate, again, as I think you said earlier, Sarita, one of the keys is someone who you know you can trust, whether that's your preacher or your rabbi or your minister, or it's a family member or it's someone in healthcare that can allow you to find some of the options that are available to you, or a community member.
Also, it's very important to say that if the substance that you're addicted to is alcohol, or, you know, sedative hypnotics like benzodiazepines like Xanax, Valium, Klonopin, or, you know, barbiturates, anything in that category, you can't just stop suddenly. The withdrawal could be life-threatening. And so then you have to actually get detoxed under medical supervision. But if you're, you know, using pain pills, heroin, the detox can be, the withdrawal is extremely unpleasant, but it's highly unlikely to kill you unless you're already medically ill from something else. But that's important for people to know too. And then another thing that a lot of people, even in healthcare, sometimes don't think about is that if you're a pregnant woman and you are addicted to opiates, then it can be very risky to stop. You know, it the treatment of choice is actually to go on to methadone maintenance and now increasingly Suboxone maintenance, because the detoxification from opiates during pregnancy can sometimes trigger a miscarriage. But I know there are parts of the country where these treatment options are not available. And so I guess your only option is to detoxify. I've never lived in a part of the country where it's not available, but I think there might be. So do you have any advice for pregnant women, what they should do?
Well, again, what you're saying is accurate, Sarita. There, we have significant differences in our country depending on the location where you reside. There, this might sound shocking. It does to me even every time I say it, but our laws in this country are predominantly created in the state that we are residing in. Two of the 50 states in this country right now, today, in the United States, have laws on their books that make it a felony for a young woman to be opioid dependent and pregnant. Two states. What stronger message do we send to a young pregnant female than to stay in the closet? Don't disclose. Don't seek help because of the potential of the punishment. And so, absolutely, it depends on where you live as to whether or not the majority of this country, though, thank goodness, perceives and understands that there is reason for a safe harbor and a reason for us trying to help people. As you alluded to, Sarita, for someone to just decide to stop what they've been taking and their body has become dependent on, it can put the fetus at risk for sure. So the most important thing is to have help, to have assistance, and to, if they're early enough in pregnancy, they can potentially be tapered, but by far the better, safer way for fetal as well as mother health is to stay on a maintenance dose medication that is legal, that is prescribed by the doctor or their healthcare provider through the pregnancy.
Now, what about, you know, women's bodies are different from men's bodies. They're very different, not just for pregnancy and the childbearing years, you know, but in general. And we have this phenomenon called telescoping, which is discussed more in alcoholism, but I think it applies to a lot of drugs, where women will start using later in life, you know, maybe not in their teens, maybe in their mid to late 20s, but by the time they are 35 or 40, they have caught up to the same physical, social, every kind of consequence that a man would have acquired over a much longer period of time. And some of that is just how their our bodies are different from men's. And some of it is the social aspects. So with your unique background and, you know, you're an attorney, you have training in pathology, you know, psychiatry, forensic psychiatry, can you tell our listeners a little bit about, you know, how physically this affects women more, but also socially, legally? Why this telescoping phenomenon?
Well, it's a good question, Sarita. And as both of us have mentioned earlier, some of telescoping is there's still significant differences, not only in physical and mental health between genders, male and female, but also significant differences in our society about how we treat people and how we allow people to be encountered in our society with, if it's someone that we still have those traditional roles in many places, that the male is the hero, the male is the warrior, the male is the breadwinner, the male goes off to war and comes back damaged, he needs help. versus some of the trauma that occurs in the life of individuals when they're childbearing or taking care of children or allowing themselves to be in a situation that the burden that they carry is every bit as complex or more so. Women, as you said earlier, yes, there are differences that as they become later in life, many times they don't have the health care that's provided to them. And the health care that is provided to young women when they become pregnant many times is not at the level that the health care is even for our males that are athletes or our males that are in situations where they have had consistent health care throughout their life. So telescoping is basically a word that we use professionally to talk about the further along the journey that they go, that there are more significant complex consequences.
Right, right. And also women are often, sadly, they first get introduced to a drug through a man in their life, someone they've been dating, someone they've been in a relationship with, married to, and then they become addicted to the drug, then the relationship ends, and then they're sort of left with the addiction. I mean, when you take histories from women entering treatment, so many of them will say that they first got introduced to the drug through a man in their life, and then the relationship ended, and then they were left with the addiction, you know. Now, a lot of women, you know, struggle with the whole issue of, you know, going to AA or NA and having to use the words, you know, I am powerless over my addiction, which is a core concept in trying to get sober, to say, not that they're powerless over their addiction, but they're powerless over the alcohol or the drug, and that, you know, their life has become unmanageable. But a lot of them have been in the situation of having been victims, and now they kind of struggle with using the word powerless when it relates to their drug or, you know, the alcohol. What do you say to them when you're sitting in session with them? Like, if they say to you, Dr. Soper, you know, I'm not comfortable saying I'm powerless over alcohol when, you know, the word powerless somehow, you know, what advice do you give them?
Well, I think that's a challenging point for any of us when we're trying to help people. And I think that part of the willingness to surrender, to realize that any of us carry a burden in life when we try to do something by ourselves, and especially when it's gotten out of control. So many times I say, in order to empower yourself, you have to let go of the myth that you, in fact, have it under control. When there's so much damage and so many consequences, then, and there are solutions and there are options for us to use in healthcare. The powerless word, I think, is a big stop, and it is a big stop because it's there in that first step. Admitting that we're powerless, getting out of denial, and allowing yourself to start preparing for what can I use, what are the other options, what is available for me to start back on the road to wellness. And sometimes it has to be done incrementally in small steps. Sometimes I like to allude to the difference between those of us that have high blood pressure or have diabetes. If a diabetic doesn't have insulin, a diabetic can be powerless over the consequences that uncontrolled diabetes causes, loss of eyesight, loss of limb, kidney failure, et cetera, et cetera. And many times it's the same thing. If we can move out of the stigma of thinking that this is about character, it's not. The person is strong. The person has character. The person has the ability to make decisions. It's just if we assist them within a team approach, doctor-patient or patient and other care providers, then it has a better probability of the outcome of health, and that's what we're seeking, is healthy lifestyle choices.
That's great. So we're coming up to another break. You're listening to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. Today's topic is women, drugs, and pregnancy. So please join us on the other side of this short break. We're talking with Dr. Rich Soper.
Stay connected. Sign up for our newsletter. Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
Tune in to Your Health Workshop Weekly for the most up-to-date information and support on a variety of health issues. Host Mary Shulman, a best-selling author and patient advocate, will speak with guests and answer your questions on items like thyroid issues, hair loss, hormone balance, diet, and more. We'll bring you the support and tools so that you can be educated on what to do next when visiting your doctor and other medical professionals. Your Health Workshop airs live every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific on Voice America Health and Wellness.
If you have a loved one that is undergoing treatment for substance abuse or mental illness, you owe it to them and yourself to tune in to One Hour at a Time with host Mary Woods. This compassionate and educational talk show will help you help those that you love by better understanding their condition and their personal recovery process. Tune in every Monday at 12 noon Pacific Time to One Hour at a Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Recovery begins this hour.
Your life, your health, your network. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Now, back to today's program.
Hi everyone, you're listening to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao, and our guest today is Dr. Richard Soper, who is a physician and an attorney. He is specialized in psychiatry, forensic psychiatry, addiction medicine, and also has specialization in pathology. And so we're talking about women, drugs, and pregnancy. So let's talk a little bit about motherhood, Dr. Soper. So, you know, mothers in all societies around the world have this sort of dual status. That's what I think, as a woman and a mother and a physician, that, you know, on the one hand, motherhood is sort of highly respected and is kind of a role within itself. Like, you know, if you have children or if you have a child, then you automatically get it's a subtle but pretty pervasive thing where you automatically have a lot of value in society, so to speak. And people, you know, feel positively towards you, and, you know, they'll, if you're standing with a child, they'll let you get ahead of them in the post office line or something like that. And, you know, during pregnancy, women get so much positive attention and caretaking. But on the other hand, I think societies, you know, everywhere in the world, not just the United States, but, you know, they just have these idealized images of what a mother should be like. And I think more and more in our own society, I feel, between the media and also how women themselves deal with things, this idealized picture of motherhood is going further and further away from what the reality is, where now you're talking about, like, you know, the best way to do everything, you know, pureed organic baby food. And that is so far away from the mother who is, like, you know, still struggling with drugs and alcohol. So I wonder if you have any, like, philosophical thoughts, you know, as a physician, you know, about this whole picture.
Absolutely, Sarita. And I think you very well stated. I think life is hard, especially in this day and age and in this culture. And when we have not only our own needs, but we have the needs of others to take care of, particularly when they're our children, and they might be our children by adoption, they might be our children by circumstances in the family that have occurred, that someone has sort of left them, and I'm really the aunt or the uncle, but all of a sudden I'm the care provider, it makes it very difficult. And I think, as you alluded to, that we idealize and fantasize that the mother is supposed to be this, whether it's a Hollywood image or an image that we saw in a Norman Rockwell painting or something that we were taught or we saw somewhere in a museum or in a play, but the actual reality of the day in and the day out and the I've got someone that is in need and dependent on me and I have to provide them not only with food, clothing, and shelter, but make sure they get their education and make sure that they're a whole person and that they're beginning their life and that they're guided. But I think that it's almost like chicken and egg, as you alluded to before. If we are, there's nothing more important than our role as providers in families, because if we are able to be a parent and provide our young children with the ability to be nurtured and supported, then they hopefully will not be the next link in the chain of self-destruction or of self-medicating behaviors. Most of us are creatures of habit. If my parents use nicotine, it's a high probability I'm going to use nicotine. It's the standard. It's the norm. It's what I was around. If my parents used alcohol, most likely I will. We've got now, at least in my area of the country, the epidemic of methamphetamine abuse and addiction. And so you get individuals that from literally toddler ages are being exposed to in their homes methamphetamine or opiates. So thoughts
that is,
of
that
where
is
we go with that, I think is a continuing challenge in our society that all of us in all of our roles are going to have to deal with.
Right. The drugs actually are getting worse, I think. I mean, in many ways, drugs and alcohol have always been there for, you know, a long time. Probably fermented berries were there from prehistoric times. But I think, you know, you mentioned methamphetamine, which we in New England and the Northeast really don't think about that much. I mean, we think about it, but it's somehow mysteriously, you know, not a big deal here. For us, it's all like, you know, opiates, heroin. But methamphetamine is a huge epidemic in big parts of the United States, and it's such a dangerous drug, and it's, you know, people are making it in their bathtubs, and people are making it in their homes, where it does become kind of a family business.
Well,
yes,
I think
I mean,
in Connecticut, if I'm not mistaken, it was in one of the national medias just a week or so ago about the epidemic of heroin use, that, as we talked about earlier.
That's our issue, is the heroin. It's a big epidemic. Now, one positive thing that I see, it's not a research study, but just simply, you know, in my experience of treating, you know, pregnant mothers with substance abuse problems, at least around here, is that you are seeing, thankfully, a dramatically less alcohol use. So I see moms who are like, when they find out they're pregnant, they've just, you know, they stop drinking right away. They still smoke, though. I mean, there's a tremendous denial about smoking, but they still smoke cigarettes, but they stop drinking, but then they don't stop, let's say, the heroin or the cocaine, you know, but at least they stop drinking. So that's, I can't remember the last patient I saw who, after they found out they were pregnant, like really continued to drink. So a lot of times pregnant women will make like some healthy choices. They'll cut back or they'll stop the alcohol, but then they'll keep other stuff, you know, on board. And then sometimes there's so much denial, you know, which is part of the brain disease, where they have so much denial about the fact that they are harming themselves and, you know, and harming the baby.
Well, I think that's a good point, Sarita. And I many times have the patients say to me things like, well, I quit this, so why do I need to quit that? And I've gotten rid of that, so I'm not drinking anymore. You mean I also have to give up my cigarettes? I think your point's very well made.
You know, the nicotine is a big issue, and because it's legal and you can't get a DUI, you know, people still don't understand how risky that is in life in general for a man or a woman, but particularly a pregnant, you know, pregnant woman. Now, what about socioeconomics, Rich? You know, you and I both know as practicing addiction specialists that, you know, it makes a difference. I mean, there are these different groups of women. There are women coming from upper middle class households in suburban areas who see their private OBGYN doctor and they don't typically get drug tested, or they may be, you know, mothers and they're drinking, but there's somebody else in the house. They have a husband and they drink, you know, they still ferry their children around to all their activities and do all the household work and sort of drink in between all this. And everybody's, it's sort of a don't ask, don't tell. Then you have your inner city mothers who, you know, are doing similar things, but they're much more likely to fall into the hands of Department of Children and Welfare and legal authorities. So do you have any thoughts about different treatment options or the different challenges that these two groups of women face?
Yes, and as we mentioned earlier, I think that the first step is, again, getting out of denial and realizing that someone in that is in the healthcare profession might be the first person that I talk to or I speak to. I think that, as well, it's not just the responsibility of the individual. The responsibility of us as family members, the responsibility of us as healthcare providers or whatever our role is, if we see someone that we know is potentially participating in harmful self-medicating behaviors, then how much am I also potentially at fault if they're a family member and I say nothing about that in a caring way? Hey, what can I do? How could I help? Hey, is there anything that I might be able to help you with? So I think that, as you mentioned, the companion or the significant other that continues to abuse a substance, knowing that my female companion or wife or partner is at risk for using that. She's trying to abstain. She's trying to go through whatever it is in life without using anymore. It puts her at risk if I still bring into the environment the same substance and I'm using it. So
right.
I think we all have a role and a responsibility. It's not, this is a family disorder. It's a community. It's a society disorder. It's not the individual that we can put off and park into a dark closet and say, take care of it yourself. If we each are able to, in a caring way, help those that we have in our life in meaningful roles, then I think we're doing our part.
And do you have any thoughts about, you know, one of the big challenges we face, as physicians, when we approach patients with drug or alcohol dependence, is that the denial is part of the disease, and it's a brain disease. So it's, here's a disease in the brain, and the person appears like sane and making rational decisions, and they are in many areas of their life, but when it comes to choices around keeping their addiction intact, and they're not making rational decisions. So, do you have any thoughts about how to kind of, if somebody goes to their primary care doctor, even it's hard for the primary care doctor to break through that level of denial. Do you have any advice for family members, like if they want to get help for their loved one, but that person isn't listening to them, is there somewhere they can turn to?
Well, again, I think it's a slippery slope for us to try to become a doctor if we're not, or a nurse if we're not. And the role that we have, as you mentioned, it is the definition of addiction, both in the addiction medicine professional community as well as in the psychiatric community and in the legal community now, is that it is a primary chronic disorder of brain reward and motivation and memory circuitry or system. And so if we realize that not only our federal government but our healthcare professionals and our legal professionals are acknowledging that this is a chronic disorder, then hopefully we can start, and there's been efforts in our society to start moving the conversation to where we're allowing people to get help, and that if individuals can understand that it is something that is an impairment of health, and we need help with trying to treat that. And the good message is that we do have options for treatment, but we do have to get involved with the healthcare profession for those options to be exercised. We still have about, as numbers you mentioned earlier, about 80% of the people in this country that suffer from addiction are not involved with the healthcare profession. They're still struggling. They're still having to self-medicate. They haven't had an initial assessment. And there's so many other consequences from use, whether it's hepatitis or whether it's legal consequences, whether I'm involved in a car wreck because I'm driving impaired. The consequences from it are devastating. They can destroy family and they can destroy individuals. And what and how we can move to help our fellow man or ourselves, I think, has to be something that we as a society try to address. You know, there's been articles in all of the media, and we're seeing, unfortunately, that the media covers more frequently someone that has a celebrity attachment to their name, and when they have consequences, we see that, and we don't see the after message of they're seeking help or they're getting help or they're on a better path.
Right, right. So this has been great. You've been a really informative guest, Rich. We really thank you for coming on and talking about this important topic. So what I would urge anybody who listens to the show is if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol yourself, please get help. And if you are a woman or you have a woman in your life that you love who you think is having a problem, you know, start a conversation with them. And a good place to go is your primary care doctor to start out with. You may not know any kind of healthcare person other than that person. So that's a good place to start out with. And, you know, or Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous in your local community. So thank you again, Rich, Dr. Soper, for coming on the show today. And you just heard Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. Please look at my show's Facebook page, Dr. Sarita Rao Radio Show, to find out about upcoming topics and guests. And it's been great discussing this important topic today. And we will see everyone next week.
Thank you again for tuning in to Mental Health with Dr. Sarita Rao. Please join us again next Thursday morning at 6 a.m. Pacific Time and 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Have a great week.